Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
AI is making waves in every field it touches. President Biden is now on TikTok, and the election draws closer each day. With so much going on in the world, it is hard to keep up with it all, let me tell you. Hi, I'm Kai Ryssdal, the co-host of Make Me Smart. It's a podcast from Marketplace. And every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I break down the latest in business and the economy with short daily episodes to make it easy for you to stay in the know. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts.
We're kidding ourselves if we think people will stop talking.
You're one of the Monterey Five, right?
Monterey Five?
Just the way he said it, you know.
How did he say it?
Like the off-scar letters on our pecs.
It's gonna get us. It's gonna get us all.
What are you talking about?
The lie.
Hello and welcome to the last episode of Still Watching Big Little Lies. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I'm Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
Usually on this show, we watch the episodes ahead of time and we kind of record our discussion ahead of time, but we did not have an advanced screener of the finale. So both of us have just watched it live. We were recording our hottest takes. I've had some rosé, but not too much.
Literal hottest takes.
Appropriate.
It's like 100 degrees in New York. And because of, you know, sound stuff, I can't have a fan or anything on. So, you know.
Yeah, we're schwitzing a little bit on either coast. So we wish we were in temperate Monterey. I mean, I know Oakland's usually pretty chill, but it's actually quite hot here today. So anyway, we wanted to let you guys know this is the last episode we were recording for Big Little Lies, obviously, because the finale aired tonight. We are taking a 2-week break, and then we will be back to talk about another HBO show. This time it's season 2 of Succession. So still watching Succession is coming at you on August 11th. So don't unsubscribe. And 2 weeks gives you enough time if you haven't watched season 1. Richard, do you want to make like a real quick case as to why Succession is a show people want to catch up on and watch with us?
Yeah, because it was such a sleeper hit last summer that people were kind of catching up with as the year went on. I really think that like all of a sudden on your feeds, Facebook, Twitter, wherever, you're going to be like, why is everyone talking about the show? And it's because it had such a big build over the course of the past year. So I think that like it's going to be a big summer show. It's very of the moment. It's both, you know, pertinent in political, social ways, but also just a really fun, juicy, well-acted soap. So it kind of hits on a lot of different levels. And I predict big things for season 2 for that show in terms of its audience and the way that people talk about it.
It's an interesting, it's a kind of a, I guess, more traditionally masculine show. Most of the main characters are men. This is about a family dynasty who will take control as the patriarch, played by Brian Cox, is sort of sometimes ailing, sometimes not. It's a little Game of Thronesy in the boardroom with one daughter and two sons, and then like a bunch of other, you know, would be havers of the crown. So
three sons.
Oh, Three Sons.
You're forgetting a loser who lives out in the Southwest, which I think is kind of the point.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, Alan Ruck. Poor Alan Ruck. Poor Cameron. All right. I'm glad you knew exactly which one I was forgetting, too. So, yeah, Three Sons, One Daughter, Striving for the Crown. This is a show that I ignored at first because I was like, doesn't look like it's for me. Then actually an ex-boyfriend of mine was like, you have to watch it. And so I finally did, and I really loved it. Richard did a great interview with Matthew McFadden, who is not one of the sons, but is one of the Strivers on the show, for our other podcast, Little Gold Men. And it's a great interview, great performance. Love him on that show. Yeah. So.
And I would say also as an additional selling point, at the end of Succession season one, you wanted there to be a second season.
That brings us to back to Big Little Lies. So as we, I think we mentioned last week, and we've sort of been circling throughout our entire discussion of Big Little Lies, this show had sort of a heavier lift than other shows because it needed to like prove its existence in the second season. There was a first season. We all liked it. It was supposed to be a contained thing. They went through almost the entirety of the book material. And so why come back for season two? Well, come back for season two because everyone liked it and it won a bunch of Emmys and the actresses wanted to like hang out and work together again. And you can't really blame them for that. But as like critics or critical watchers, our job is to wonder, should they have let like good enough alone with the first season? And I was an initial defender of the season, and now I think I'm a little bit on the other side of that. I'm definitely on the other side of that argument. But something we're gonna like sort of break down the finale and go woman by woman, which seems to be a good strategy for us. I think it worked well last time. Before we get into that, we wanted to talk a little bit about the Andrea Arnold news that broke last week. After we had recorded the episode, if you listened to last week's episode, you would have heard a little intro from me being like, sorry, we're not going to talk about the thing everyone's talking about because we recorded this early. So here we are a week and a half late to the discussion of IndieWire's sort of big piece from Chris O'Fault titled Big Little Lies Season 2 Turmoil Inside Andrea Arnold's Loss of Creative Control. We had sort of been talking about we had some suspicions around this, I will just say, because for one reason, some inside baseball, like nobody was giving any interviews, not just like the big stars, but like David E. Kelly, Andrea Arnold, like nobody was talking. We had noticed that Jean-Marc Vallée and a bunch of people named Vallée were editing the episodes. It was just like, we had a lot of questions. This piece, while not maybe the whole picture, starts to provide some answers for some things that we might have suspected. If you haven't read it already, I don't know, Richard, do you have like any kind of synopsis for folks if they haven't caught up with this article?
Well, the gist that I took away, because you know, we still don't really know what was kind of said to Andrea Arnold at the beginning of all of this, like when she was signing the deal, like what did it stipulate, you know, what had been either tacitly promised or literally legally promised or whatever, you know. But basically it seems that Arnold sort of had her creative control over the season wrestled away by you know, show writer David E. Kelly, who brought back in Jean-Marc Vallée to edit and direct, kind of direct and not sort of reshoots exactly, but just sort of retool the episodes that Arnold had already shot.
But a few literal reshoots.
Well, yes, there were actual reshoots, but also like, you know, the question is really whether or not they were clear with to Arnold that like, you know, in the end, we do want a unified Big Little Lies. We can't have season one look and feel like one thing and then season two feel like something entirely different. So it's really not clear, well, how clear they were about that. And either way, it becomes this narrative of men wrestling control over away from a woman. And none, you know, let alone a woman as accomplished and revered as Andrea Arnold is. You know, so it's a really, really tricky thing. And I think made me think harder about, which I should have thought harder about maybe last season, about how like this is, you know, one of the more defining sort of shows about women that sort of presaged or just kind of arrived right before all the Me Too stuff happened in 2017. It was created by a man based on a woman's book and then directed by a man. And so it just kind of highlights that like who is telling this story and how are they telling it and how are they acting behind the scenes in the telling of that?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I have a couple takeaways on this article. what's true is that TV is not a director's medium usually, right? Usually on a TV show, a director comes in for an episode or a couple episodes, but it's like the showrunner's, purview as to what the show looks like. Then there's something that we started to call auteur television, which really started to crop up, I think, the first time, like, I remember talking about it is around Cary Fukunaga in season one of True Detective. But when a director, and especially like an acclaimed film director, takes on an entire season's worth of episodes, then you get this sort of unified look and they have some ownership over what they've done. Not as much as they would if they were doing a feature film, but still more than your average TV director. So that's true of Jean-Marc Vallée for season one of Big Little Lies. It's definitely true of Jean-Marc Vallée in Sharp Objects. We did a lot of interviews around Sharp Objects and it was really clear how much he shaped that story. So I can only imagine that that was true for Big Little Lies season one as well. There's a script, but then there's also the way that he shapes the story. They wanted Jean-Marc Vallée for season two. He said, no, I want to do Sharp Objects. HBO or whoever couldn't wait for him to be done with Sharp Objects. And so they said, let's go with Andrea Arnold.
Right, because you'd have to imagine with the talent that they have for this show that the window you have to shoot this is extraordinarily narrow, you know? And so when it's ready to go, it has to go.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right, Richard, that for me, I have two sticking points. One, well, let me back up really quickly and say it is our impression, or I would say it is most people's impressions as journalists reading this piece, that this is a piece that was given to IndieWire from Andrea Arnold's camp. If not Andrea Arnold directly, like people who know her. This is the Arnold side of the story without it being a direct interview with Andrea Arnold, right? Yeah, HBO has like a sort of a canned... Yeah, HBO has like a canned bit of like PR response in there, like we couldn't have done this without Andrea Arnold, but it's not really like sourced on the other side of it. Would you say that's accurate?
Yeah, I mean it's interesting. I was just in Los Angeles for the week doing some stuff for work, and I had dinner with two friends who are actors, and we were talking about this story, and they were like, that was their first question. They were like, who is this story coming from? Because it didn't really have an origin point. And that's not to rush out and defend David E. Kelley or Jean-Marc Vallée or even HBO. It's just like it is a curious piece because it just seems to be coming from this place of omniscience that's like not necessarily delineated like who the sourcing is. I think the natural assumption is that it's coming from Arnold's camp, if not her directly.
Right. And I'm not discounting the story. I just feel like it's one piece of the puzzle, but it's a piece of the puzzle I'm happy to have because HBO would rather we have no pieces of the puzzle, mm-hmm. right? So we have this. I would love to hear from the other side, from David E. Kelley, from HBO, from Reese or Nicole, who are executive producers and Reese, at least by all accounts, and hands-on executive producer. So my sticking points are twofold. Number one, exactly what you said. I just would like to know what Andrea Arnold was told. If she was told, we'd love for you to shoot this, but ultimately Jean-Marc Vallée is going to come in and shape it. That's one thing. And then my second sticking point, in all of this is, I feel like we were sold this season. I feel like they took a lot of pride in hiring a female director, that they tried to sell us an Andrea Arnold season without it actually being an Andrea Arnold season. And that is the part that doesn't sit well with me, is this message of, I don't know, sisterhood that feels, you know, a little fake. And especially, you know, none of the women who work on the show have commented on it, which I'm sure is like, you know, their strategy contractually, blah, 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 but like they've not said anything about it. So I don't know. It's just, it's sort of sitting very oddly with me.
Yeah, it's sitting oddly. And then it sits even more frustratingly when you look at this final episode and sort of wonder, game out what could have been had the person, you know, if you believe the IndieWire story, who had been hired to do a job, had been able to do the job that she wanted to do, you know? Yeah. I mean, the scripts were the scripts no matter what. I don't think that Arnold really had any sway over that. So maybe there was no way to, in my mind, redeem this season. But I had a this was a rough one.
All right, so let us start with Jane, because I want to start with a listener email You and I had a very like strong negative reaction to Corey in last week's episode, and I thought that that's what we were supposed to have. And then we watched this episode, mm-hmm. and I was like, "Well, guess Richard and I were wrong." Anyway, so Carolyn wrote in to us, and she said, "I'm writing about your take on Corey suddenly not being a good guy because he's pushing Jane to not give up on him. I really see this as the opposite of what you guys said. I think there are many times in life when people need others around them who love slash care about them enough to push them into doing things that are difficult for them. Jane is pulling away from Corey because she's damaged, right? But Corey knows her and he cares about her deeply. And I think that if he just ultimately gave up and didn't try to push Jane a little, then he would just lose her and that would be it. And Jane would be confirmed in her feeling that he likely didn't care about her enough to make the effort. I think that in all relationships, sometimes one person has to push the other to be the best version of themselves. It's a sign of caring. And I mean, obviously, if he continues relentlessly and gets creepy, then it becomes not okay. But him coming to tell her that he's not giving up on her, I thought was really sweet and was a sign that he's actually a really good guy who truly cares about her and Ziggy.
Fair. All right, so but like, yeah. You know, you can send a text message. You don't have to show up on the beach unannounced.
Yeah, I mean, like, obviously Carolyn's perspective is the perspective that the show ultimately has on Corey. That he's a good guy, that it is Jane's trauma that's getting in the way of her trusting him, and that, you know, ultimately she's somewhat rewarded in this episode by letting him in. That is coded as the right thing for her to do in this episode. I still think it's just, maybe that work encounter is okay, but still it feels boundary pushing because it's at work and she doesn't have control over how she can react to that. And then when he shows up at the beach, and then also like in this episode, when it's like her small child giving her relationship advice, no matter how precocious that child is, I don't know. It all still doesn't like, once again, doesn't sit super well with me, but apparently I'm wrong. So I don't know.
Well, I really appreciate, you know, anyone who writes in to us or anywhere else and has a kind of nuanced read on the show, because I love nuanced reads and I love different reads than the ones that I have or the ones that we have on the show, on this podcast rather. But I wish that the series actually gave room to that nuance. And I think that in this finale episode especially, there was no kind of allowing for that and everything felt relatively tidy and cut and dry. And so that my inclination, I guess, is to, I don't know, if there were to be a season three, maybe not give it so much kind of interpretive leeway, I guess.
Yeah. I'd be interested to see, you know, it's so interesting. Like this, we'll talk about it when we get to the end of it, but about whether or not we feel like there should be a season three, but season three exploring Corey's good guyism would actually be interesting to me. Mm-hmm, so, so what do we think of Jane's arc overall in this season? You know, given that it ends with her sort of like smooching him, like we're going to leave out the very last scene because that's something we're going to talk about at the end. But up until then, you know, she's allowing herself to be sexual again, which feels like positive growth for her, all that sort of stuff. What do you think of her arc from the beginning of the season to the end?
I mean, I think it was certainly the most subtle and it was the most grounded in a way. You know, and I think that it might be kind of tempting to call it simple, but of course there are huge things happening, behind Jane's eyes, you know? And I think that, you know, so much of the season was focused on Celeste and her trauma and what, you know, what Perry's absence meant for her and for her kids and for her mother-in-law, that I guess it's nice to be reminded that Perry being not on the earth anymore, can act as something of the mechanism that frees Jane a little bit, that, you know, that the latch has been lifted in a way. And so to that end, even though I don't necessarily agree with the way that Corey kind of persisted, I think that it's nice that she gets a bit of, you know, whatever existed before Perry. We never really knew that Jane on the show, right, might be kind of coming back. You know, I think that they were joking about like having fun and going out and getting drunk at bars and talking to people. And then at the end, we see them having their own version of that. She's having a glass of wine. They're in the safety and like kind of protective realm of her home and dancing like they might at a bar. And, you know, like I thought that was sweet. And, yeah, you know, So I don't know. That was probably my least, despite the fact that, like, you know, you and I were going a little bit hard on Corey last week, I still felt like that resolution was the most satisfying to me, even if that was a story that I was less invested in this season.
I honestly feel like if Corey just had not appeared in last week's episode,
yeah,
I'd be like really into like every, you know, if you just totally. Like delete those scenes, I'm like, cause I was really feeling him up until then. And if she was just like, if she comes and confronts him and says she needs some time, and then he doesn't show up for all of the penultimate episode, and then he shows up and he's like, hey, let me in. And she's like, okay. Like, I like that story. Cause I want to like him. We love that actor so much. He's such a cutie. And like, we want this for Jane, right? We want a healthy, happy, like, you know, being a, quote unquote normal, like sexual being in the world. We want that for her. So.
Yeah, and especially because the only way that a season three of this show could work if it's an Everwood crossover. And so obviously Douglas Smith's brother, Gregory, was the lead on Everwood. So like we need to be in the good graces of the Smith family is what I'm saying. So
I didn't know that. Everwood is a big blank spot in my Chris Pratt and Emily Van Camp, but that's all I know. So
well now I know what you're doing in our 2 week break.
Catching him on Everwood. All right. Yeah. Let us move over to Renata. In Renata, in this episode, we get sort of a coffee shop confrontation with Mary Louise. We get her sort of like in the courtroom. And I want to say really quickly, we'll get to the full courtroom scene, but like, actually, I think my favorite moment of the episode is when Celeste shows the footage and you just get the silent reactions from, Laura Dern, everyone, all the women just sitting there reacting and being very upset. It was tremendous. And so, like, I was like, ugh, these actresses are so good. Why is some of the writing so bad? All right. So, and then Renata comes home and Gordon literally has all his toys. His playroom is intact. And then she goes ham on it and beats it with a baseball bat and then hits him in the stomach and then says, enough, I'm done, and kicks him out and then sort of like goes and cozies up to her daughter, Amabella. So for me, I will just take this first. This is extremely dissatisfying to me because I feel like if you plot Renata's arc for the season, it's like Gordon is a piece of shit and Renata puts up with it, and then does it. And that's it. And I just don't, and like, there's no nuance with Gordon. He's just terrible and reveals himself to be more and more terrible as the season goes on. And like, I think something that you and I had a question mark about is like, why didn't she just throw him out right away? You know what I mean? Like, that seems like what Renata, it would not take 8 episodes for Renata to get here. And once again, it feels like another, like, Renata loses her cool. So the internet has some gifts about like, you should have shown a woman some respect or whatever, which I think is beneath Laura Dern, who's a tremendous actress and she deserved more nuance. I think you and I discussed my favorite part for her this season was the party, you know, just like watching her take in Amabella and sort of like some of the improv Laura Dern did with like her coworker, her castmates and stuff like that. Like, it's just, that worked for me. The Gordon stuff doesn't, and the Gordon and her kicking Gordon out as like the ultimate payoff feels like, why didn't that happen in episode 2? So, what do you think of the Renata stuff?
Well, as a gay critic, I feel that I can reclaim a very offensive skit from the 90s, which was Men on Film, and put on my little hat and say, hated it.
that's a Damon Wayans in Living Color situation.
Yeah, right? Exactly. Yeah. Go consult your local YouTube if you want to know what I'm talking about. I thought it was so stupid, and I thought it was so like just meme ready and lazy. And we've seen her do this. I mean, look, the train set sucks. The husband sucks beyond measure. I'm not mad that she bashed up with a baseball bat, but that should have happened in episode 2. You know,
episode 2.
Like there was no arc here. It just felt sort of thrown in because they wanted to get another big scene for Dern. And you're right. I mean, the best, you know, Dern is such a subtle, beautiful, wonderful actress, like, you know, and can work in all kinds of genres, you know, and I just think that this is such a, you know, I mean, and look, far be it from me. Maybe she's having a blast, and if she is, great. But like, I think that like, fan intelligence is higher than HBO is giving us, or the show creators rather are giving us credit for with this stuff, you know, like, you know, yes, like Twitter is fun, but like I participate in that, you know, that realm right. of Twitter. And like, I like a good Laura Dern meme, same as the next person, but like this just all felt so forced.
Yeah.
And repetitive, like you said. We had the thing in the yeah. mouth last week. We've had the, you know, the others. It's just like, okay, like we get it, you know. So I was kind of bummed about that. It just felt really you know, beneath the show.
Right. And I was like waiting for Gordon to have like something interesting, you know, like what does she see him in the first place? And like, and honestly, it feels like character assassination of Gordon in season one, who I didn't like him or whatever. There's this whole episode in season one where like he has sex with her in her office, and it's like this whole thing where she's like, you know, I don't feel like you desire me, and he's like, I do, and like they have sex, and, you know, and so for him to just be like slime in the core of him, slime, then you're like, why was there not ever with him? Like, why did it get to this
right.
point? Anyway,
I mean, I think a great thing, you know, about his characterization in the first season was that he was so emblematic of those husbands on The Real Housewives, particularly of OC, where you're like, these fucking shifty guys, like, they're so like cold and obviously duplicitous, and there's something off about the relationship, but like maybe there's something there. Like I like that he was a kind of a character, he was a trope, but like he still made a little sense in the human world, whereas this stuff where he's right. just like, well, I guess I needed something to play with or whatever, it was like, well, that's just now, that's like bad playwriting, you know.
Absolutely. And I was like, oh, he gets to keep his literal toys, I get it, men are all boys, got it. All right, let us zoom to another rocky marriage with a different ending. This is Madeline and Ed. So Madeline's arc this season is Ed finds out she cheated on him. They have a rocky time of it, and then in the end he's like, no, let's work it out, and they renew their vows with their kids. And then like a pretty like cute sequence, like the vow renewal and the storm and them running in from the rain and stuff like that. But overall, like, and then we also get a little bit of lip service, like her scene with Celeste in the car, where she's like, I'm sorry, I should have seen this, you know, like that's a scene for Madeline this episode. But overall, like that's the arc, is like Ed finds out. She tries to make him understand that she's gonna like make good or not do something like this again. And then Ed forgives her, and they try to take another clear-eyed stab at, their marriage. There's a very telling line in this episode when Adam Scott's character Ed says something like, this isn't just like a tidy neat bow on this. Like, this isn't a happily ever after. And I'm like, isn't it? Anyway, what do you think of the Madeline stuff?
Well, to go back to Real Housewives, I did appreciate the little joke about marriage vow renewal, because that's a big trope, especially on OC.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. Well, it was, at least back when I used to recap it 3,000 years ago. But, you know, it was pretty. I mean, you know, the inadvertent Midsommar reference was funny.
Yes.
Yes. But I don't know. In that conversation where Ed and Madeline are talking, very well acted by both parties. And you know, he says, this isn't some tidy thing. I'm like, that's a reasonable grown up way to approach this. But then she's like, yeah, and our best and our worst. And he's like, no, we're done with your worst. And that to me felt, I thought that was supposed to be kind of pointed. And then the end seemed more sort of hopeful and triumphant, where I was like, that's kind of a shitty thing for someone to say. And it's even to someone who's fucked up a lot, you know, like, because it sets up it bakes in an inequity, and it bakes in a guilt and a constant seeking of forgiveness and checking to make sure you haven't, you know, wronged the person again. Like, that feels very, very, like that's the pee under the many mattresses that will eventually start to irritate this marriage again, if that's how he's going into it, you know? And so I don't know, that did not feel like the happy, like reconciliatory conversation that maybe the show sort of made it out to seem with the cute wedding scene at the end. Or maybe I'm, you know, not giving the show enough credit and saying that was deliberate, you know?
I mean, maybe it's hard to know. Like, honestly, I think my read, either I'm rusty as someone who like feels like they understand storytelling, or this season is truly edited in a way that like makes it hard for me to understand intention. But like after my wild misinterpretation of Corey last episode, I'm just like, I don't know. I think the show wants us to see this as a happy new start. And you're right that like him saying, no, your worst is unacceptable. I'm like,
We've done that already. Meaning you can see me at my worst. I get to be my worst. You don't get to be worse.
Right. It's
like, then, I mean, I understand that in terms of a like eye for an eye situation, but like that's not how to build a relationship. You have to kind of undulate and be flexible with it. And I don't know. I think that's why I've never really I don't think Ed has ever been a particularly friendly person or a very giving person on the show. And so it's been a little bit tough to watch Madeline and the way that Madeline's story has been framed this season as this scramble to like win him back over because she, you know, transgressed. And I don't know that to me, and not to like, I mean, you know, I'm a man too, but like, that's what felt like the most like a man writing this show.
So, one of our listeners, Kara wrote in, and she asked, this question is more on brand for Little Gold Men, but here it goes. Little Gold Men, once again, is our award season podcast. Depending on the release date, will Reese be up against herself at next year's Emmys with Big Little Lies and Little Fires Everywhere? I say this with all the adoration in the world because Reese is my queen, but she wants that Emmy bad. And it seems crazy to have both in contention during the same award year. Kara just says that Reese would be her front runner for getting the Emmy out of the Monterey Five. Little Fires Everywhere is a you know, an adaptation of a great book that Reese is producing and co-starring in, and I think she would be considered supporting in both of the projects. So,
but she was lead. Herself? She was lead for Big Little Lies last time, wasn't she?
Oh, was she? I thought she
was her
supporting.
And Nicole, and then Dern was supporting.
Oh,
but the other question is, my friend, how is Apple Plus going to play the morning show?
Oh, the morning show. What if Reese is in like every category?
Right?
Reese also needs to like host SNL so she could be in like that category as well.
She needs to make an Emmy for Reese like Megan Amram did, or she needs to like dominate all categories. Yeah.
Let's make 2020 Reese in every category for the Emmys. So she got her Emmy as a producer, exec producer of Big Little Lies. But yeah, you know, as we've discussed, it felt like a lot of Madeline's storyline was an interest of getting, Reese that, performance Emmy. If she's smart, she would put herself into supporting somewhere. And I think this season makes a better case for her in supporting than last season did. I don't know. I'd be very interested to be a fly on the wall of Reese's awards campaign team meeting.
Well, I think the first meeting of that was just the writer's room for this season.
I mean, they made a mistake not having her fling that ice cream. I'm just saying.
I'm sure Andrew Arnold would say, you're damn right they did.
Okay. All right. So let's zoom over to Bonnie. Bonnie is a character. So like Bonnie was, my argument early on was that Bonnie was the reason why it made sense for this season to exist. That the first season did her a disservice and that the second season had an opportunity to make up some ground and give Zoe Kravitz a little bit more of the spotlight and some of the issues that Zoe Kravitz felt was like Zoe Kravitz herself was left out of season one, which is like this question of race and dynamics there, into the second season. So, in advance of this finale, I should say, not having seen the finale yet, Shamira Ibrahim of Atlantic wrote something called What Big Little Lies Doesn't Get About Bonnie. And I'll just read like two pull quotes. You know, it's a great article. Please go check it out. But I'll read two pull quotes. She writes, the show fumbles an opportunity to explore the implications of a Black woman coming forward and admitting to killing an influential white businessman. The fact that Black women may not be believed in these situations, and even the nuance of the detective who is doggedly pursuing the group being another Black woman. Bonnie reconciling her trauma is an experience that she largely goes through alone, despite having a pre-existing bond with Celeste, who knows well the complexities of domestic violence and the guilt that comes with being victimized repeatedly. And so basically, like the the gist of this piece from Shamira is that season two really had like a chance to do Right by Bonnie, missed that opportunity, you know, with the caveat in this article that like maybe they'll come through in the finale. So here's what I'll say about the finale and whether or not it came through for Bonnie. There is one line that I really actually genuinely loved in the finale, and it's this. It's from Nicole Kidman, and she's talking to Madeline, and she says to Madeline, basically, we have a friendship and Jane, but the Monterey Five or whatever we call ourselves, the lie is the friendship. And that, it doesn't go all the way to fixing it, but I like that that exists in there, coupled with what happens at the end, where it's just sort of like Celeste admitting this sort of quote unquote sisterhood that we've claimed to have for each other, the support system that we claim to have for each other. We've left a few members, specifically Bonnie and Renata, high and dry and kind of out of the inner circle here. We've fucked up in this regard. And the end can be seen as sort of a make good for that. So a make good for like leaving Bonnie, deserting her when she needed help. That's a good self-aware aspect of the episode. It's still frustrating to see Bonnie siloed into her own story when like you have everyone in court and then Bonnie's doing what she's doing in the hospital with her mom and Nathan and all of that. What do you think of Bonnie in this episode?
Well, I think it's a couple things with Bonnie. One, like she, you know, I think that with regard to the Atlantic piece and how the broader season failed her, I think that there is maybe some unpacking to be done, maybe not by me, maybe not on this podcast, about the fact that the only character I can remember, you know, who, especially because she's also a Black woman, comes into the show and says, like, points out the fact that Bonnie is an outlier because of the fact that she's Black, is then also relegated to a stroke-ridden, abusive mystic, you know, like I feel like Bonnie's mom's kind of wisdom and sort of insight is kind of relegated pretty quickly to not freak show status, but sort of sideline kind of thematic device, I guess. And I don't know if that's really where this should have gone, maybe.
I feel like it starts very strong. I felt like it started very strong. I really loved that actress, Crystal Fox. And then I think like from the stroke on, it just feels incredibly messy. All of that.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. They really set something interesting up with Crystal Fox's character and the Bonnie dynamic. And I don't know they delivered. Anyway, but for this episode in particular with Bonnie's kind of final arc beside the last scene where she's telling Nathan that I don't love you, and I maybe never did, that also felt like, where is that coming from? Like, because textually within this season, maybe I was missing things. Like, I thought that her pulling away from him had to do with the guilt over the lie and over the incident with Perry, but I guess there was something else happening too. And again, I might have missed things, but that felt kind of like another instance of this episode trying to give its actors big moments that didn't feel really either earned or contextual.
Right. I actually think Zoe Kravitz is quite wonderful in this role. Mm-hmm. And I think she's quite wonderful, in most of the season. I just, on the one hand, I'm happy that they decided they want to explore more for her. On the other hand, I'm unhappy with sort of like the back half of how all of that went. And I didn't think about it until I read that Atlantic piece, that there really was an opportunity to better weave Bonnie into the story by having maybe like a bond with Celeste. Like how, I mean, this is Monday morning quarterbacking, but how interesting would it have been for Bonnie to maybe talk to Celeste about this abuse, for them to bond over it, and for Madeline to have some weird, like, the petty jealousies that she had in season one about Bonnie to have them revisit again, but this time in like a friendship sphere, the like ebb and flow of friendships. I think that would have been, women, all friendships are complicated. I will only say from my own experience that female friendships are complicated. There are a lot of jealousies that can then involve, and like for Celeste to have something that she could connect with Bonnie over, and for Madeline to maybe feel left out of that, that's a very fertile territory. Once again, something that maybe might have occurred to a female writer that didn't occur to Davy Kelly. You know what I mean? But it better integrates Bonnie into the story to have, like, to have her have a connection with, you know, one of these core three, you know, that I guess Celeste is setting up, herself, Madeline and Jane as a core three, and Bonnie and Renata as satellites. And maybe that's something they could do in season three. This is, we're just going to keep like questioning, is this something they're going to do in season three? Let's find out. All right. Are you ready to move to the big show?
Celeste, yeah. Let's rest our case.
All right. So this email comes from my friend Clint, who actually wrote in sort of unsolicited last week to be like, what the hell was that courtroom scene? He's a lawyer, I should say, clarify, practices here in San Francisco. And he gave me like a bunch of reasons why the legal, aspect of the penultimate episode really bothered him. And you and I were like kind of praising it. We're like, David E. Kelly back in the courtroom. This is not, we should say, this is not a legal documentary. So if you want to sort of take some poetic license, with the legalities of something, that's sort of, kind of okay for me if it seems natural. And so whatever missteps there were last episode, I was just sort of like okay with it. In this episode, the flagrant disregard for like how the law works and how courtroom decorum works, finally got to me. And so I'm going to read you, Clint's email, which I made him write me, which starts in all caps, "All right, you asked for it." And he writes, "So as bonkers as last week's trial scene was, this week's scenes were somehow worse. In every court in America, Celeste's strategy of representing herself and somehow forcing Mary Louise to admit that she low-key murdered her younger son would never have worked. Mary Louise would have done the obvious thing and simply denied everything. Celeste would have looked like she was desperately hoping to connect on a Hail Mary. It would have been an embarrassing waste of time, only furthering the notion that Celeste had lost the thread. However, in Monterey Superior Court, Judge Marilyn Cipriani's courtroom, where there are absolutely no rules of evidence, civil procedure, or decorum, it worked swimmingly. Put simply, not a single one of the questions that Celeste asked Mary Louise were proper. There were, by my count, only one objection from Mary Louise's attorney. It was an entirely proper objection that Celeste was using her cross-exam to testify to something Perry allegedly told her. Perry is, you know, dead. This is classic hearsay. The objection was overruled. Shruggy guy of Emoticon here. Celeste also used her cross-exam to testify to things that her kids told her, that Jane told her, and that she herself wanted to stay. That's not how any of this works." And then, as Judge Cipriani is literally reading her ruling, both Mary Louise and Celeste simply interrupt the judge to give speeches. Neither lawyer objects. The judge doesn't mind. If you tried to do this in actual court, you would likely end up in jail. To be clear, the result was correct, and the ruling that any judge in the state would have been obligated to make. This is not a close call. That's fine. We got drama. It was a legal clown show, but c'est la vie. However, my gods, Judge Cipriani is the worst TV judge I've ever seen, ever. I'll fully expect her to be Trump's next SCOTUS nominee." All right. So Clint, that is Clint's, interpretation of the law here. I will say, I think it seemed a little nuts to me that Celeste, suddenly discovered video evidence of Perry beating her and was able to like bring it in. And then this like whole twist, I should say, our listeners emailed in and be like, "I think there's something about that dead brother. I think there's going to be a twist about the dead brother, blah, blah." And we're like, "Guys, no, that's not what this show is." And then I was watching this episode. I was like, "Well, fuck, that's what this show is." Okay. Legality, decorum, and all of that aside, this is a classic. And I tweeted this, a classic Perry Mason rule, where Perry Mason, this, I don't know if you guys ever watched Perry Mason. I watched it a lot growing up. It was like a thing I did with my mom. A classic Perry Mason thing is like Perry Mason, in order to like clear his client, last second accuses someone else in the courtroom of doing the crime and they confess in the courtroom and that's it. Case closed. This happens every week on Perry Mason. And so for Celeste to be like, "You killed your son," I was like, "What is happening?" So that's my rant coupled with Clint's rant. What do you think, Richard?
Well, it's always funny when, or frustrating also, when something that's been good, I mean, arguably the season of Big Little Lies has been great, but like, you know, I love the first season. A lot of good things show their weaknesses in courtroom scenes. because as much as I love a good, you know, Matthew McConaughey in A Time to Kill or whatever, you know, Denzel Washington in Philadelphia, like I love courtroom shit. Everyone does. That's why it's such a popular genre. But court doesn't work like that. You know, court is boring. And I mean, yes, sometimes sensational things happen, to wit, you know, People versus OJ or whatever, glove, you know, the glove stuff. Court's boring and very procedural and very formal. And, you know, it's like watching Senate hearings on C-SPAN. You know, we want the big, you know, Mr. Smith goes to Washington speech, but it's mostly just like point of order, you know, all that boring stuff. And this felt like a particular indulgence. I mean, I barely know what a law is. And I was like, this doesn't seem right. Like, right. I don't think that's what happens there. Even if there's no jury and it's just the one judge deciding this, like, I think that, like, because if this kind of stuff was happening willy-nilly, every single case decided in this whole county court would be up for appeal, you know, because it's like all absurd. It's a circus. Does that mean that Nicole Kidman and Meryl Streep were bad in the scene? No, of course not. They were great. But like, I just, you know, it was just silly in a way that I think the first season of this show was fun, but it's always interesting when a series doesn't seem to understand what was good about itself, you know? And this felt like obviously it's David E. Kelley. He has a long history with this kind of stuff, but that the show even had the impulse to do this tells me that like, It was viewing itself as a very different show than I was viewing it as.
Yes. Something that like I've heard from a lot of our fellow, like our friends, fellow critics, et cetera, is when I say stuff like this is so unbelievably soapy, they say Big Little Lies is always a soap. And I don't know that I can disagree with that. You know, like Leanne Moriarty's book was like, that's a beach read book. Like that's the kind of book it is. Not to discount beach reads. Beach reads are fun, but they're soapy and that's what they are. And so like the fact that season one, has a lot of suds to it. Maybe I can't disregard that, but there's just something about the way that season one hung together that made the soap feel like it had, like to discount it as just soap was to ignore the very real things it was saying about domestic violence and all these other things. And so I find my ability to justify the suds and the melodrama of this season, you know, I can't excuse it. Like, you know, last week we talked about how there were certain scenes where I'm like, this feels like a dream to me. I thought it was a dream sequence that this character was going to wake up and then know it was real, like that Jane and Mary Louise thing where she was like, did you, you know, do you have a gun? Did you bring a gun? Did you come here to kill my son? You know, like stuff like that. And in this week's episode, once again, when like Mary Louise shows up to Celeste's house and like, actually, like every time something weird has happened, we're like, okay, but Meryl's really good. So like, at least we have that in that scene. I mean, I might be assassinated for saying this, but like, I'm not even sure Meryl was great in that scene at the house where she comes and she's like, no, stop telling lies. My boy, you're wrong. My boy. I was like, what is happening? Like, what is this? I did not connect with it. It did not feel anchored in any kind of reality. And I just, I hate to be too harsh on something that clearly a lot of people enjoyed, but it did not hang together for me at the end here at all. So,
yeah. I mean, I'll say this about the soap opera thing. Soap opera is a descriptor that can be used in a few different ways. One is quite literal, you know, a serialized drama that was sold by soap companies and other, you know, household product companies, or advertised at least, and then we kind of have expanded it to mean something that feels frothy or plot twists or melodramatic or something like that, you know. And I would say that the first season of Big Little Lies, like, hit at least the plot twisty stuff. But, like, I don't think the show is ever melodramatic, really, you know. I think that it's not, you know, it's not Erica Kane, like, you know, dun-dun-dun kind of, you know. It was never that.
Right.
I mean, if we're going to describe the first season of Big Little Lies as a soap, well, The Sopranos is a soap then. It's just about a lot of characters, and I think that it's a very gendered kind of descriptor, you know, and maybe I'm being a little bit too, you know, on my soapbox about that, but.
No, I mean, I would love to interject really quickly and say that, like, calling season one a soap opera is a very dismissive thing that a lot of people said that, like, you know, Kate Arthur, who used to work for BuzzFeed, and I forget, is she a Variety now? I forget. Kate just got a great new job. Congratulations, Kate. But she was the one at TCA 2017 who was, to me, railing against a lot of, frankly, male critics who were discounting Big Little Lies season one as soap. And she was like, I think that's some gendered bullshit. And I think she was right. But I think season two, fell victim to some of those suds. And I don't think it's gendered to say that. I think that that's just, it was some sloppy writing that was sort of backed up by, you know, some very conflicting, editing / directing.
Yeah. You know, and that was supposed to be frustrating, is that in the first season, I really don't think it was, kind of fair to paint it with that sort of broad brush. And in this season, it's like, yeah, go ahead. You know, culminating in that, those court scenes, which, were entertaining, but like, I didn't believe any of it for a second. And that it makes it that much harder to connect not only to the sort of emotional beats of the moment, but also the performances, you know. I've been kind of wanting this to be the kind of great Meryl Streep return to a slightly less draggy version of her acting, and I think it was there. It fits and starts this season, but by the end of this, I don't know. It did just seem like a lot of flustering in a wig, to be blunt about it. Can I say one more thing about the courtroom scene? Sorry, that I just reminded of.
Hit me.
There was one last thing I wanted to say about the courtroom scene, and in particular, Celeste, when she's kind of speaking her case to the court, is when she says that she did all she, you know, her best. She said, "I kept them alive. I kept myself alive." And like, however you want to frame life under an abusive partner, I thought that was super powerful. And as a way of thinking, like, that was a struggle to even do that, you know, to sort of manage the both. I mean, how much control you have over your physical well-being, I guess, but like to manage the really scary mercurial whims of this guy, like, and again, not saying the onus was on her to do that, but she did do it long enough, you know, to get the apartment, to try to leave, you know? So I thought that was a really crucial sort of thing for her to sort of assert in there that made us remember what kind of ordeal she was living under, I guess.
Yes. Which is it's tough when those moments shine through. Like I said, that reaction shot with all the other actresses as they're watching that footage, when those moments shine through, you're like, I want to love this season of Big Little Lies. It's saying something, it's saying some very important things, extremely important things. And, so I want it to be great. I'm rooting for it. I'm rooting for all these actresses. I'm rooting for the subject matter that they're trying to tackle. And I think it's a shame that, it just really failed to hit the high bar that season one set. Mm-hmm. And that once again was, you know, unfair or not, the challenge it had, to justify its existence. All right. So let us then veer, over to the ending, which where, you know, we see Bonnie text Madeline. I confess I did not pause to squint at the text. But you know, the gist
it says, LOL you up.
Yeah. LOL you up. Gonna go confess to murder, or self-defense or whatever you want to call it. So Bonnie says, basically, I'm going to the cops. Madeline texts, Celeste. Someone texts Jane and Renata, and they all decide to go in together, sort of paying off that earlier line where Celeste says, like, the friendship was a lie. This is them actually showing up for each other as an actual support system for each other in the end. And they walk into the police station, which felt like the inevitable place that this, you know, this season of like, okay, what do you do when you lie and say what's, if your big little lie is we didn't commit the murder at the end of the season, is like somehow they all have to reckon with that. And then, you know, that sets up season three, I guess. And I should just say really quickly that, speaking with News Corp Australia, like the, you know, the women of Big Little Lies, the main actresses have not been giving a lot of press. maybe because of this Andrea Arnold thing, I don't know, but Nicole Kidman was talking to, you know, a hometown News Corp Australia. And she says, I think we'd love to do a season three because there are certainly ideas, but we would not do it without all the same people involved, even the kids. You know, and she's like, there's so much more to come. So basically, like, we have more stories to tell, more to tell in season three, which is sort of similar to what they were saying at the end of season two. So my question to you, Richard, is, does this ending feel satisfied and or self-contained to you, or does it feel like a really clear swing towards to be continued?
Well, I really want to see the gang go to Abu Dhabi. You know, I think that would be so fun. That's worked out well in the past.
Sorry.
You know, I felt like...
I'm sorry. I love a Sex and the City reference. Just FYI, if that's... People didn't know what Richard was doing.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. Sex and City 2 for those. It's on Delta's on-demand thing. Anyway.
Wait, did you watch it on your flight? Is that why it's a fresh reference for you?
No, I watched 5 feet apart instead.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, because Teen Weepies, by the way, like Fault in Our Stars knockoffs are great to watch on planes. Yeah. Because you're more susceptible to crying.
Yes.
You never see them normally. So that's my recommendation. Anyway, I don't know. I'm of a few minds about this. One is that this should have been the end of like the second episode of the season.
Yes.
And we should have just like seen the repercussions, and then we could have had a nice tidy ending at the end of season two and no more. I think that I like your read that this, you know, and I think it's in the show that this is them being like, wow, we've really failed Bonnie on this regard. And then them unifying around her. I kind of wish that more of why they had failed her had been teased out, and maybe some of the stuff about her otherness in this group of white women was teased out more. And I also think with regard to season three, like, okay, so they do that, but then what? You know, it's my understanding that in the original book, they do confess, and then everyone just says it was self-defense, and they kind of get off. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but I don't know. I don't see where else these narratives go beyond, like, another trial.
Right. Let's tease this out really quickly. Renata's new single life.
Right.
Jane and Corey's relationship. Madeline and Ed's second chapter.
Bonnie inherits
Bonnie
her
without
others second sight. Solves crimes medium style.
Wait, I just want to see that spinoff. That's it, just Zoe Kravitz. Forget everyone else. Like,
Fox recurs like as a ghost character who like mentors
ghost her. Mom. Yes, call it ghost mom. Mm. Love it. Greenlit, absolutely. You know, and Celeste. Yeah, I just don't. I don't know. Like, Celeste represents the gang again. Like, I don't know. Like,
Celeste meets a good man, you know, and Shane navigates Corey becoming, you know, a sort of stand-in father Ziggy. Like, there, I guess there is stuff there, but then it really starts to settle into more traditional. I mean, this is such a, I shouldn't even say domestic drama, but you know what I mean. Like, it settles into more sort of familiar TV storylines,
right?
And I don't want to see that really at all.
I mean, I'm a little interested in the kids. I'll say this. I think a lot of those kid actors are really good, and I'm interested in like Chloe's future or whatever. But you know, like Meryl, I don't think is coming back from San Francisco. So, you know, do we have whose mom have we not met? Like Renata's mom, Laura Dern's mom comes to town, and it's,
well, I mean, she's got a mom built in. No, Diane Ladd. So,
and
you can have Brewster's dad.
Bruce Dern. Yes.
So like that would be exciting.
Fam.
You know, and then I don't know, Reese's mom could be played by anyone from, well, Shirley MacLaine, Mary Kay Place, Mary Steenburgen, Candace Bergen. I mean, we could really,
yeah,
there's a lot that could be done there.
Big Little Moms,
yeah,
season three.
that's the new Meet the Fockers. Yeah. Let's just cheapen this thing as much as we can now.
All right, we go now to our conversation with Poorna Jagannathan, who played Katie Richmond, the lawyer who was hired by Celeste.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love. Books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson. Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. I mean, the jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply.
Hi, Poorna. How are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing so well. Thank you for chatting with me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, my God. Thank you for inviting me to the chat.
Absolutely. Let me just dive right in. I just wanted to kick off. I want to start by asking you what your reaction was when you found out you were cast on this project.
Oh, I'd go into physical therapy right away because my shoulders were so crunched up from both the absolute joy and the complete overwhelming sense of stress that the news brought. It was really both. It was crushing stress and crushing joy at the same time. It's definitely the most elitist cast in the world. and stepping into that world was both sides of the coin.
So when you get your script and you're looking at your script and you're thinking,
okay,
I get to, I talked to Nicole Kidman a bit. Okay, I'm in scenes with Meryl Streep. Oh, I get to sit here front row for this scene in a courtroom where Meryl and Nicole Kidman go at it. What was that, knowing that, like for you?
I would have taken this role no matter what. I would have taken an invitation to be part of this cast and the story no matter what. I'm really, first of all, intensely drawn towards stories that have a theme of sexual violence in them. And, you know, this is not only the theme in it, but also done so beautifully and so in such a moving way. I do say it was front row tickets to the best acting in the entire world. And I know for sure that my acting shifted after seeing the courtroom scenes. Just in terms of how, because as an actor, you have the script in front of you, you know what the lines are, and then you see them completely interpret lines differently. Mm-hmm. And handle the scenes differently and go at it constantly in different ways. I never expected to see something like that in my life.
Yeah. So I was, I'm given to understand that there was, room for improvisation or looser takes on the script, in this particular shooting environment. Is that something you witnessed? Is that something you got to experience? Did you get to improvise? How did that work with the script and what?
So I will say, I will caveat all that I'm saying is that the courtroom scene had no improv in it.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Everyone very much stuck to the words. It was also one of the tensest sets. It's one of the most emotional and tensest sets that I've been on during those days that we shot the courtroom scenes. This show comes from a culture of improv as well. It's really encouraged. I didn't see that much of it because, most of my most of my scenes are within the, within the courtroom.
Right.
So yes, I hear that's the case.
You're like, allegedly, I didn't see it.
Yeah, I mean, of course, you know, Nicole would. I mean, with Nicole, like, I have definitely seen actors not get out of characters. You know, I've worked with John Turturro, and you know, I've seen that before, but I've never seen a character move in on an actor. You know, so that was the main difference. So yes, before the scenes, Nicole would improv before the scene starts, get into get an engine running under the scene. And you know, the first time she did it, I was completely blindsided, and all I know in improv is like she would plead the fifth, like that's all I know from like Law and Order and all that stuff,
right?
So then I, you know, like I don't know how to improv as a lawyer, you know what I'm saying? But then I immediately went and called lawyers and judges and, you know, just trying to get much more outside language from what was written.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. You know, you were involved in Night Of, did a great performance in Night Of,
yeah.
Which is a legal-based show as well.
Mm-hmm.
I did have some lawyer friends watching these Big Little Lies courtroom scenes and saying, like, this is not how it's done. And I'm like, okay, but, you mm-hmm. know, we're allowed to have some poetic mm-hmm. license. It's fiction. We're going to, you know, mm-hmm. do the law mm-hmm. how we want to do
yeah.
it. Well, you know, what degree do you think that sort of freedom with how law actually is practiced in the courtroom, you know, is fine for a TV show? And when you were calling up your lawyer or judge or whatever consultants were any of them like, this isn't how it's done. And you're like, sure, but if it were, how would I do it?
There was definitely a judge who couldn't get past the scene. Like, she was so amazing. But, you know, it took a while for her to say, this is not how it's done. Are you kidding? Like, all of them wouldn't be allowed in the, you know, like there's a scene where all the women join Celeste after the hearing's gone really badly.
Yeah.
And she's like, I can't. There's no way this would be allowed. So, you know, it took a really long time to kind of loosen them up and said, okay, suppose.
Right.
So. For sure, there is creative licenses and, you know, just in terms of language and format, of course. David E. Kelly is a master of this universe and so can play around with it for dramatic effect.
For courtroom suspense.
Some
people in universe, in the show itself, and maybe some of the fans think mm-hmm. that your character Katie is not a good lawyer. Do you think Katie is a good lawyer? Do you think she's doing a good job?
My favorite detail on Katie is that Meryl Streep's lawyer, played so beautifully by Dennis O'Hare, says to Meryl, "Look, here are the list of the top 10 lawyers in the area. Call them and conflict them out." You know, and I love that detail. I think, this is my take. I think Katie's a really good family lawyer. However, this is not a typical family law case. It's kind of a criminal custody hybrid. And, you know, something that is very much outside of her wheelhouse. And the, you know, I think she's known to be kind and smart and nurturing, but you kind of need another personality to deal with the criminal court case, which is really true. Like, you see the difference in personality between family lawyers and criminal lawyers, and it's really significant. I went to both. You know, courthouses, both types of courthouses, and they had different energy. The lawyers, a different energy. Family court lawyers are much more, I would say, you know, there's a feeling that they're much more, play the role of friend, of therapist, of nurturer, than you see happening in the criminal law systems.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think a lot of it comes down to style and what style suits what. And, Katie never strikes me as incompetent. A lot of her advice seems really correct. You know, like, don't lose it. They're trying to make you lose it. Don't lose it. You know, all of that. I'm like, yes, Katie, you got this. Anyway.
I think she's, you know, they're up against a hard case and she has a very volatile client. So two things are exceptionally hard. And I think, you know, the fact that Celeste is a lawyer, we talked about this a lot with Andrea, you know, why would Katie take a case like this? It's fraught. But she, you know, she must have come into it with the understanding that Celeste is a lawyer, meaning, you know, you're going to settle. Like, that's what lawyers know happens. So there is a feeling Katie must have known or must have felt that there's no way Celeste, you know, wants this to go to court. And, you know, there's this whole thing that's obviously not paid up, but Andrea really wanted to plant that seed in us, which is, you know, Katie's own background, why she's drawn to family law, and perhaps because of what she's been through, why she's drawn to Celeste's case in particular.
I know that advocacy around sexual violence, as you already mentioned, has been something that you've been quite interested in the theater and the projects you pick.
Thanks for reading up on that. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and I'm just curious, you know, what you see. You've already mentioned a little bit, but maybe a little bit more in depth, what you see in Big Little Lies, how it's changing the conversations we have around this sort of thing, and what good it's doing, sort of beyond the fun, soapy, look at all these actresses we love together on the screen.
I think Big Little Lies is really a vital entrance into the Me Too conversation. I mean, I believe it was shot before the Me Too movement.
Season one was.
So, you know, I do believe that, which is, you know, I felt this during the night of, which is it's a show that actually took a long time to come out, but it came out during the zeitgeist of topics like Islamophobia and the prison system were being talked about. So it suddenly seemed hugely relevant, and it's a really good show, but the time that it came out in amplified its message, and I think it's the same for Big Little Lies. And it's a beautiful, and you know, season two continues to do that, a beautiful portrayal of the complexity of sexual violence and the complexity of justice that is given to sexual violence survivors. And Mary Louise, in many ways, is, of course, an unbelievable character, but also represents also holds in her the elements of what society thinks about survivors, the not wanting to believe, the being in denial, the wanting to pull the rug underneath a survivor, the need to protect, you know, the predator. All that is just, it's you know, it's beautifully played in season two.
And when you think about the decision to make that character, that skeptic, that voice of skepticism, a female character, because I think we're used to seeing that from male characters. But, you know, it's definitely true that there are women, especially women, like circling the wagons around their sons who behave this way. So what do you think of that choice?
I think it's a hugely human one because she's a mom. I have no idea what I would do in that situation if I was a mom. You know, I think all bets are kind of off. But as a mom, she represents something bigger. And yes, you're absolutely right. There's, you know, the I know this is especially true in India, where the beacons of patriarchy are also the women. And the shift that needs to take place in terms of mindset are among both genders, not only one. So you know, Meryl played it with so much. I mean, the character is great, so unfiltered, but she played it with so much humanity. You know, I often tell the story where she you know, as an actor, when you play a villainous character, of course, the thought is you can't ever think of your character as a villain. You have to see the humanity in them, which is definitely how Meryl played it. But I've never seen an actor being so protective about their character because of this reason. You know, as like, you know, if you're on set and the director, the producer, the writer say something, you will step out of character, you know, take the notes, and then go back in. That's just what I've seen.
Right.
And Meryl was, it's not that she wouldn't entertain any comments. She just wouldn't entertain any comments that were insinuated that she was the villain of the piece, or wanted, you know, any comments that wanted to ask her to up the ante on the villainess. She was just very protective of her character.
And what does that look like when she, and I'm wondering if you as an actress are taking notes, this is how to say no to a note.
She would literally say, that's none of your business.
Oh, okay.
I literally did a double take, and she's not saying that out of being rude or anything. She just has to protect the integrity and the humanity of her character. That's the place she was coming from.
That's none of your business. That's great. I'm gonna write it down. I'm gonna use it at some point when someone asks me.
Yeah, me too. Watch me get fired so fast.
Oh, yeah, that's true. You have to be a Meryl in order to pull that off. Okay.
Totally.
I wanted to ask you another theme that is explored in this season that I think was sort of pushed to the side in season one, was this question of white affluence. The fact that, like, four of these women are white and one is not. And, you know, what that means for Bonnie, why this community is isolating for her. And then, you know, there are a few other characters, you know, in the season, the police detective, a teacher, something like that, who's not white. Mm-hmm. So, you know, what does it mean? How does this inform your character's role to be a non-white woman dealing with, like, you know, this white family drama in this town?
Oh, my God. It's such a hard question to answer, I got to tell you. You know, when I first watched season one, I didn't watch it. I just watched an episode of it. I'd obviously heard about it, but I just wasn't drawn to watching something with so many white people in it. You know, my viewing habits have changed, and what I want to support and what I don't want to support at all. You know, it affects me. And then I saw, you know, a couple of episodes on a plane, and I was so drawn to this beyond races, themes of motherhood and sexual violence and vulnerability. And, you know, I immediately related to them. It's a powerful thing for them to have done that, because I'm, you know, pretty skeptical. But yeah, I wish they had explored it in a more full way, I got to tell you. I know it's a very white community. I know that's the reality of it. But I do wish they had explored it much, much deeper. I'd read somewhere that Zoe had suggestions on the fact that, you know, she's married to a white guy, and there's definitely no comments about it. And in reality, there'd be a lot of comments about it. And I agree with that. The otherness is not explored as, it's a very well-written show, and some themes and characters are underwritten. That's definitely what I feel. And the aspect of color is introduced but not fully explored.
And then, you know, to that end, if there were a season three, you know, I've been asking, they're already talking about, like, you know, Nicole Kidman gave an interview.
I know.
Like, we'd love to do a season three. So if there were a season three, like, is that among?
I got to tell you, I watched, because I read the script, and I watched yesterday's episode, and I was like, oh my God, there might be a season three. It's not it's not the script I got.
Oh, what was the, what was the difference in the script you got?
I can't tell you, but, you know, one character doesn't even make it. One character, like, dies. It's a different script than than what I got. And this version left the door open on something I thought that was definitely closed. So I found that really interesting. The first time I knew about it.
Watching it was the first time you knew about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I wonder, I mean, this is a show because of all the like dreamlike cuts and the way that it's edited. This is a show that mm-hmm. I can imagine the version you have in your mind when you're shooting it, when you actually watch it for yourself, is quite different.
Yes.
Was that your experience throughout where you're like, I didn't realize that that's what was going to happen there, sort of thing?
100%. I actually thought, 100%. I thought the editing was, I know it's come under a lot of politics and criticism, but I was really surprised at the editing and the movement of the flow of the episode. I thought was great because of the editing.
And you know, to that discussion about the editing and Andrea Arnold and the directing, I'm just wondering, like, what your observations were of the mood around Andrea on the set or working with her, what your personal experience was around that.
I was, obviously this happened after shooting.
Right.
I didn't see any of it on set, and it was quite the opposite. I thought the courtroom scene is really, again, as a viewer, I'm not sure how it plays, but sitting in the courtroom was really brutal and really triggering for many people, including me. It was a really hard thing to sit through for those many days. Especially as Celeste plays the video, it's brutal, and they didn't show as much, of it as they did during the filming of it. But it's really brutal. And so Andrea would come between takes and to give direction. She'd be like, her eyes would be red. She'd be crying. There'd be, the camera operator was crying. Everyone was weeping. It was a very comfortable female-led set. I don't know if that makes sense to you, but it was sitting in its femininity. And, Andrea was really directing from her heart and directing from the importance of the subject matter at hand, and she was moved throughout it. She was moved throughout the process. I've never seen that. I've been, on so many sets where the material is hard, but the director always, is just a step removed. Because I get it. They're, whatever. But Andrea just sunk into the material. And that's what, I think that's what everyone really felt on set. Her crew and the cast just felt that the material was in the hand of someone who really cared.
And I know I've heard women performers say that before, that like, you really cannot underestimate the impact of having a woman director, just in terms of like, there are things you don't have to worry about. There are things that are automatically going to be understood that don't need to be explained or lost in translation. And then that's just the benefit of that. Not to say that like everything needs to be directed by a woman, but in uncertain subjects, it's helpful to have a woman behind the camera on it.
Yeah. I've had many, many female directors behind the camera.
Yeah.
I've never had something like this before.
That's amazing.
Every time she'd come to give direction, like just seeing her would change the environment constantly.
And so then, I don't want you to feel like you have to say anything that you don't want to say or anything that might, upset anyone, but I'm just,
go ahead.
Like what your reaction was then, given that that was your experience with her, what your reaction was then to hearing, this news about the way things have been handled sort of in post-production.
I mean, I was really saddened by the news. I also have worked with HBO before. And I also know that any piece of information is always very complicated, and it's not that there's two sides, it's multiple sides. So
right.
Obviously, if I was saddened by the fact that Andrea perhaps didn't have a fully fleshed out experience, because I think she's a genius and I think the material is great. But I also am fully in the awareness that I don't know the full story.
Yeah, I mean that was my sort of takeaway from reading the piece that went up in IndieWire. Is just sort of like, I feel like mm-hmm. I know some of the story now. I would like mm-hmm. to hear from other parties, mm-hmm. and I would like to know the yeah. full story. You know, so
yeah,
we'll see if yeah. anyone wants to tell it.
Ponies up the things. I mean, you know, because The Night Off was so drawn out, it was right. so political, and it was so crazy that. That, you know, we knew the insider details of what was happening was not what was in the press.
Right,
you know, yeah. it's things in reality are so much more complicated. And it's a shame because, you know, she's a genius. And, you know, it seems the whole notion of female empowerment, female led and all things is tainted. But, you know, I, for one, definitely can't speak on the other side.
Right. And then, you know, let me circle back to this other question and then I will let you go. Thank yeah. you so much for your time.
Oh my God, my pleasure. Thanks for all these great questions.
Well, you know, if there is a season three, given now this new ending that leaves things open,
yeah.
You know, yeah. whether or not Katie's involved in the future, you know, what are you hoping, what themes are you hoping Big Little Lies might explore in the future?
Oh my God, what a great question. I think, you know, there's what happens with Madeline and Ed. What happens when there's been betrayal of humongous proportions and how to move forward after that? I don't know about you. There's just been a very soft shift that I felt happening, and maybe it's happening, you know, around me a lot, which is before, if something happened, the clear mandate is to leave your partner, right? And
right.
I think the language has shifted around that. But I feel it. I feel like we're trying to figure it out, or we're becoming more conscious about talking about how to figure stuff out. Better. So I'm really, you know, looking forward to exploring what it means to move beyond a massive betrayal with Celeste. And again, you know, motherhood, and what does it look like to be highly flawed and highly messy? And, you know, mothers are portrayed mostly as a little tidier than what they are in Big Little Lies. And certainly I felt like, is it a good idea to have her have the kids, for sure, you know, for
right.
time. And
right.
there's definitely that aspect that's introduced, right? Mm-hmm. And she admits it herself. But what does it mean to be a highly flawed mother in a very, very messy situation, and mother regardless? You know, that's, I'd love to see that as well.
Excellent. Well, thank you again for your time, for your great work, and for your honesty.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Anything else in summation that we want to say? I mean, like, what about for people who have somehow made it all the way through this episode of our podcast, but actually really liked Big Little Lies? You know, maybe you were watching, I don't know. We're all allowed to like what we like. Maybe you're watching the show for like something else. Like there was something else you loved about it. You loved the memes. You loved the gifs. You loved whatever. Maybe you more personally relate to what Celeste goes going through. So it resonated more with you, stuff like that. I just want to say in summation that I was really rooting for season two. I really wanted it to be worth it, and in the end I think it just does a disservice to season one, and I wish they had left well enough alone.
Yeah, I wish they'd left well enough alone. I wish they had maybe, I mean, yes, there were 2 years between the seasons. I wish they'd taken more time to really, really, really figure out something intricate but befitting of the first novel, you know, you know, not dishonoring the first novel. And yeah, I think if you enjoyed it, great. Like, I think that, you know, you and I, Joanna, are going into this in granular detail and sort of, you know, making it our jobs to kind of analyze things and nitpick things. Plenty of people, I believe, our own TV critics Sonia Soraya enjoyed the last episode and I think the season overall. And you know, look, I like Laura Dern memes too. I like this stuff is all fun. I had fun watching this show this season. I think I just know in my heart of hearts that it could have been better. And that's what's frustrating. I think that, like, you know, if I didn't think there was anything worthy, I wouldn't demand anything of it, you know, or expect anything of it.
Absolutely.
And that's the thing is I know it can be great because it was great. And I know everyone involved in the show from, you know, behind the scenes to on camera, can be excellent. And, you know, so it's the, I don't know, not that they're listening to this, but like, I think that you and I don't want to speak for you, but I think we think of it as kind of constructive criticism. You know, it's, we're not hating on the show. I take no pleasure in, like, you know, bashing it or whatever. It's just like, could have been great. And it was just fine.
Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, just this is a thought that I have that, you know, makes me feel like a bad feminist, but I'm going to say it anyway. I just wish they had waited for Jean-Marc Vallée. Like, we loved Big Little Lies season one. We love Sharp Objects. Like, yes, I believe in women telling women's stories like that, but Jean-Marc Vallée just really did a great job with subject matter. I think probably what happened to Andrea Arnold was, you know, I really feel for her. At the same time, like, all of this could be avoided if they had just waited for Jean-Marc Vallée, which I think is what they should have done. It cannot be understated his ability to shape something. And so, you know, that's my cool take.
And Andrea Arnold, you know, has directed television before. Like, she did Transparent and I Love Dick. But I would imagine that those are very different. These are very, very different working environments than this, you know? But the films that made Andrea Arnold big, you know, American Honey, Wuthering Heights, Fish Tank, Red Road, these were all movies that really felt found by her, you know?
She found that
these kind of actors we hadn't really heard of or had just started hearing of or who had never acted before. And, like, you know, like, she builds worlds, Andrea Arnold does. And this is not that. And I hope that this has not in any way tainted her trajectory or, like, you know, like, you know, derailed it at all, because she is really one of the most exciting directors out there. If you have not, anyone listening to this has not seen her earlier films, you really should go out, seek them out. American Honey, I know at least, is on Netflix. She's wonderful. And I think you'll watch that, see the full breadth of what she can do and be like, oh my God, like, she should be able to do whatever she wants. That said, I agree with Joanna. I think that this is Jean-Marc Vallée's show. I think that, like,
absolutely.
I'm
glad you said that. It's not at all a knock on Andrea Arnold.
No,
I think she's fantastic. I just think she, as you say, is, like, better suited for a different kind of thing. And she was never going to be the person to pick up someone else's style and sort of, like, ape it in any way. And what you really needed was the dreamy sort of thing that Vallée does, and only he does.
Yeah.
She does something else and it's incredible, but it is not this. So, you know.
No, in a way, it's almost weird that she's involved in it, because from, you know, based on stuff she's done before, you're like, oh, she must hate these people, you know? And
it's so funny, because, like, one of the, I will say this, and this is the moment of the IndieWire article that may be like, wait, who's writing this and who's giving this information? Because there's, like, you know, the interviews aren't, like, sourced, but there's some, like, I don't know, editorializing in there. Anyway, the writer says something like, you know, the idea that Andrea Arnold could be the one to match Jean-Marc Vallée's style, if that was always their intention, speaks to a huge misreading of what it is Andrea Arnold actually does well.
Right.
Like, whoever thought those two styles would mesh really, really got it wrong.
Yeah.
And I think that that's correct.
So what I would say is something I heard a lot throughout this season of this show, when it came to criticism, was I wish that they had just kept this same team and done something different. Found a different book, found different material to do, and, you know, have everyone play different characters. You can still have the same actorly dynamic to some extent, but, like, at least we're not just kind of rehashing past glory. To that end, again, going back to American Honey, if Andrea Arnold wants to take these five actresses in a van as like on a kind of music scored road trip around America, that would be, I think, the highest box office grossing movie of all time. That's my fearless forecast. better than Endgame.
I love it. My feeling about Big Little Lies is that it should have been, it should have been an anthology show. I feel that about a lot of things. Mm-hmm. Don't make it a second season. I see that you feel like you've struck gold, and you have. You can work together again, just do something else.
I feel that way about the news. Get rid of this story. Give me a new one.
Oh, that was like a beautiful Kristen Wiig sort of reading of that. Anyway, I hope you were doing like a thumb
I actually
sort of.
Was. I really was. It's late.
All right, we did it. I've had nearly a bottle of rosé, so that's not how I usually podcast for Vanity Fair. But hey, it's Big Little Lies night, so why not? All right, Richard, until we come back for Succession on August 11th, where can folks find you?
Driving the van with Andrew Arnold and the cast of Big Little Lies around America. I mean, where else would I be? I'll also be on Twitter and bf.com. Joanna, where will you be until we visit the terrible lives of the media elite?
I'll be helping Renata, I guess, burn every single thing that Gordon owns.
Oh, good. I mean, that sounds like fun. Wanted that Waiting to Exhale moment, and we didn't. We guess we sort of got it.
We sort of got it. Do you think his tracksuits are flammable? I don't know. They probably are.
Is
quite rich.
Flammable?
I'm sure they burn. I was like, for a split second when she connected with his midsection, I was like, is Renata actually going to accidentally kill Gordon?
I thought that was going to be the season 3 thing. Yeah.
I was like, is that Big Lies season 3? Renata accidentally kills Gordon? Anyway, all the men of Monterey die at some point or another at the hands of these 5 menaces. You can also find me at VanityFair.com. I covered some Comic-Con stuff, and I will be at TCA, the Television Critics Association, summer press tour this coming week. You can hear both of us on Little Gold Men, and you can find me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This, where I will be admiring your Renata memes. And we will see you August 11th.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.